Iran sees a renewed wave of poisonings at girls' schools around the country after a hiatus of several weeks. We ask the American Enterprise Institute why Iranian authorities have not put a stop to this months-long phenomenon.
Either they are incapable of preventing these attacks or they're unwilling to mobilize the resources that they have in order to prevent these attacks from occurring.
Plus, Iran's strained relationship with neighboring Azerbaijan worsens. A researcher tells us that Iran has been looking for new ways to pressure Azerbaijan since Baku scored military victories over Armenia in the Nagorno-Karabakh region in 2020. And later in the program, we'll hear from the daughter of a U.S.-based Iranian-German activist whom Iran has imprisoned since 2020 as she intensifies her campaign to secure her father's release. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. A renewed wave of school poisonings in Iran appears to be escalating, with VOA's Persian service receiving credible reports of incidents from at least 14 Iranian cities on Tuesday. One of those incidents was reported at the Al Yassin Girls' School in the city of Shahin Shahr in the central province of Isfahan. A video vetted by VOA Persian from a Twitter activist account shows a commotion at the school gate as relatives of the students kicked it open to enable them to leave, after administrators allegedly locked the girls inside. VOA cannot independently verify the circumstances of the poisoning incident, as it is barred from operating in Iran. Similar school poisonings have been reported across Iran since last week, marking a resurgence in cases that had stopped while schools were closed for last month's Persian New Year holiday. Kitane Fitzpatrick is an Iran researcher at the American Enterprise Institute. I asked her on the phone how the latest incidents compare to those from the previous months.
So they remain consistent. The reported symptoms have remained consistent from what we saw in that earlier period in March. The responses that we're hearing from school administrators are remaining consistent. So this isn't in all schools, but there are a few scattered reports of children saying that there was an attack or some type of chemical smell within the facility, and the school administrators would not let them leave, close the doors. They were not allowed to talk to their parents. They didn't call the emergency facility. So these kind of scattered reports of a really anonymous response are also consistent from what we've seen last month as well.
It seems like deja vu here. How do you assess the responses of the students, their families, and the authorities to what's going on?
It's quite interesting. So, of course, parents remain extremely concerned. It's also sparked a few protests in a few different areas where these poisonings are occurring due to the regime's response or lack of response. And regime officials also remain consistent in their messaging. It's conflicting at times. However, they do acknowledge that poisonings are ongoing. So there have been some arguments circulating online and with some regime officials that this is psychosomatic. Some regime officials themselves have acknowledged that they are not 10% of the population. One Iranian official said, I think over the weekend, these are real poisonings, even by the regime's own admission. And they still haven't really done enough to protect the students from these ongoing attacks.
How can we understand the behavior of Iranian authorities here?
I think that the behavior is extremely anomalous. It's not like what we'd see any other country react to. Their behavior is extremely inconsistent with the severity of what's going on or what we perceive to be going on. So I think that the regime is either, you know, tolerating this campaign against Iranian school children. Either they are incapable of preventing these attacks or they're unwilling to mobilize the resources that they have in order to prevent these attacks from occurring. So that's one way to read the response from the regime.
You mentioned a moment ago that some of the recent protests in Iran have been in response to these poisoning incidents, but we haven't seen nationwide protests on the same mass scale as in the months immediately after the death of Mahsa Amini last September. Why do you think it is that the outrage hasn't manifested itself on the streets of Iran with quite the same intensity as late last year? Is it because the schoolgirls have just been sickened rather than killed?
I think that the outrage from what we're seeing from Iranians on the ground, the reports that we're seeing from school children, the outrage is consistent with the death of Mahsa Amini. It's another example of the regime's inability to protect the most vulnerable segments of its population, young children and young adults. We might be seeing a less intense protest activity because Iranians are tired. They've been protesting for months at great expense to their safety. There's risks of death, imprisonment, torture. And also there's the economic situation that's ongoing in Iran. It can be quite logistically difficult to continue sustaining the momentum that we saw in September. So that's not to say that there is no possibility of protests reigniting again. Those anti-regime sentiments are still there and exacerbated by the poisonings. But it's just because the duration of this protest movement is so long that it's difficult to sustain that type of momentum.
What kinds of economic motivations are we seeing now for protests in the country?
So it's really interesting. A large portion of the protests that we're seeing more recently are economically motivated, and these aren't necessarily anti-regime in nature either. So they more signal not anti-regime sentiments, but dissatisfaction with the regime's performance, specifically the Raisi administration. We have reports that even though they've stabilized the real to a certain extent, inflation remains incredibly high. The price of basic goods are becoming increasingly unattainable for Iranians, and it's just very difficult right now. So a lot of the protests that we're seeing reflect that reality.
When we see Iranians just complaining about the state of the economy, rather than chanting slogans for the death of the supreme leader, does this reflect that many Iranians who are angry with the situation are just kind of resigned to, you know, having the same leadership in place and just appealing to those in charge to try to fix the situation rather than kick them out?
That's a great question. I don't think that's necessarily the case. The most significant thing that we're observing with protest activity recently is that even if protests are not necessarily anti-regime, like we've been seeing with a lot of the economically motivated protests with retirees, there still are large segments of the population that are dissatisfied with the regime's performance. So that latent anti-regime sentiment still remains from the Mahsa Amini protest movement. It hasn't gone away, even if they're not out protesting like they were before. And on top of that, we also have these additional demographics that are dissatisfied with the regime's economic performance. There are the human rights concerns and several other things. So the possibility of those problems compounding is, I imagine, quite a scary thought for the regime.
And we'll definitely keep an eye on it. Kitana Fitzpatrick, Iran team lead and analyst at the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Nice of you to join us again on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me.
Iran and Azerbaijan have attempted to calm their growing tensions, with their foreign ministers speaking to each other by phone on April 7th and 8th. Official reports from both sides said Iran's Hossein Amir Abdollahian and Azerbaijan's Jehun Beramov discussed ways to resolve misunderstandings and expressed respect for each nation's territorial integrity. Last week, Baku expelled four Iranian diplomats over what it called provocative actions and accused Iran of involvement in a shooting attack that wounded an Azerbaijani lawmaker in Baku last month. Iranian state media have rejected that allegation as false and harshly criticized Azerbaijan for opening an embassy last month in Israel, Tehran's archenemy. Ramin Jabarli is a sociologist at the University of Washington and a member of Iran's ethnic Azerbaijani Turk minority, which has linguistic and cultural ties with Azerbaijan. In a Monday phone call, I asked him whether the two foreign ministers talking to each other might change the tense dynamic in the bilateral relationship.
These calls may reduce the tension, but I think this is temporarily, not for long term, because Azerbaijan is considered by Iran as an existential threat, mainly because of the large population of Azerbaijanis in Iran, inside Iran. You know that almost one-third of Iran's 84 million population is Azerbaijanis. That's why Iran sees actually Azerbaijan as a source of risk, source of threat. The second factor is that after the liberation of large parts of the occupied territory by Azerbaijan, Iran is losing actually a pressure tool on Azerbaijan. One pressure tour was, for instance, supporting Armenia in the conflict. And the second was actually the transit route to Nakhchivan was completely dependent on Iran.
You're talking about the exclave of Nakhchivan, which is separated from mainland Azerbaijan by a sliver of Armenian territory.
Yeah, exactly. The exclave of Nakhchivan, actually, for connection to the mainland Azerbaijan, there is just one way out, and this is using actually Iran's territory. And Iran has always used this factor as a pressure against Azerbaijan. After the liberation of the large parts of Karabakh, there is a negotiation regarding Lachin Corridor, which somehow will eliminate Iran from this pressure factor, because Azerbaijan will no longer depend on Iran for connections to exclave Nakhchivan. So this is one factor.
When it comes to the Azerbaijani president, Aliyev, you know, his government recently expelled some Iranian diplomats. They arrested some Azerbaijani citizens whom they accused of basically being spies for Iran. What do you think is behind President Aliyev's actions here? What is he trying to achieve?
You know, there were some precautions before the liberation of Karabakh in Azerbaijan's foreign politics regarding Iran and Russia. But after this liberation, Azerbaijan's president and in general, the foreign policy of Azerbaijan somehow going through some change, especially they're trying to pursue more independent policies. And Iran, because of losing the pressure tools of Karabakh, tried to somehow activate proxy forces inside Azerbaijan. Even we had, for instance, a terrorist attack to the embassy of Azerbaijan in Tehran too. But again, after that, we see activation of proxy forces in Azerbaijan, and Azerbaijan sees actually these factors as a reaction to its independent politics, especially international politics. So after liberation of large parts of the occupied territory, Azerbaijan pursues, even as I said, more independent policies. And we can see realization of this in Azerbaijan's relations with Israel, even playing mediator role between Turkey, with Israel and some Arab countries. And we see also more clarity of Azerbaijan's stance on foreign politics. Also, I think the prospect of reaching a peace agreement between Azerbaijan and Armenia has also some impact on this rhetoric and this tension too. So Iran is losing a pressure tool here, namely supporting Armenia in the conflict, may no longer work, and that's why it has started using its proxy forces in the Republic of Azerbaijan.
You know, Iran denied Azerbaijan's allegation that it was involved in the shooting attack recently against the Azerbaijani lawmaker who's been critical of Iran, but Iran is being very vocal about criticizing Azerbaijan for pursuing the recent opening of an Azerbaijani embassy in Tel Aviv, which happened late last month. So my question is, does Iran believe that it really can change the Azerbaijani foreign policy through certain means of pressure?
I think Iran thinks that to some extent they will be able to change the independent foreign policy. I think that we will not see a retreat from its aggressive policies until I think Iran is forced to do so. That is the pattern that we saw in other countries too. I think we will see a rising tension until reaching actually a point that meets Azerbaijan's interest too. I think Iran is not in a position to wage a war against Azerbaijan because of internal factors, the economic situation, and also allies of Azerbaijan, but is still trying to make pursuing independent policies costly for Azerbaijan by activating proxy forces and somehow creating an unstable situation. So in general, I think that we may reach actually an unstable equilibrium in relation between Iran and Azerbaijan, with some maybe fluctuation followed by any events or some attacks by proxy forces inside the country.
Well, Ramin Jabarli, sociologist at the University of Washington, joining us on the line from Seattle. It was great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Ghazal Sharmad is the daughter of an Iranian-German activist and U.S. permanent resident whom Iranian agents apparently kidnapped in Dubai in 2020. He was later sentenced to death in Iran for terror offenses that his family denies. Last month, the Los Angeles-based nurse, who says her family has long faced threats of violence from Iran, made a risky trip to Germany to meet with politicians and other activists as part of her campaign to secure the release of her father, Jamshid Sharmad. In an interview with London-based news site Kahan Life after returning to L.A., Ghazal Sharmad said she used her trip to form a coalition with relatives of other Western prisoners whom they accuse Iran of holding hostage. Speaking to me last Saturday, I asked her why the families have decided to join forces on this project.
The reason is when your loved one is taken hostage or kidnapped by a non-state actor, so by a regular criminal, you know what you have to do. Your responsibility is to call 911, and then a task force comes in. In the U.S., the SWAT team comes in, and experts come in, and you have people who hold your hand, people who tell you what's going to happen, people who take responsibility and try to free your loved ones and make sure that the criminals are held responsible. But when the same thing happens to you, and the people who took your loved one hostage is another state that your state is making business with for years and has a different relationship with, who do you call then? We are completely left on our own. We don't know what we have to do because we're talking to our governments and we don't have a person, we don't have an organization that is specialized on that. And we saw that in the U.S., years ago, when Levinson was taken, when James Foley was taken, they didn't have an organization neither. But the family's pressure, together with activists, formed what we have right now, which is the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs in the U.S. that works in the State Department, that works with law enforcement, that works with the press and all of those things to bring hostages home and to make sure this does not happen, to make sure families are supported. We're missing that in Europe. Even though the Islamic regime's hostages, most of them now, are European hostages.
So are you and your fellow activists in this group, are you trying to get the European Union, for example, to create their own version of Roger Karstens, someone who has that kind of responsibility?
Exactly. That's what we want to do. And we're starting off with our own MPs that we're contacting right now, but we're also working with the German government and all the other governments to make sure that they are also reaching out because it is in their interest to work together with their allies. So we're doing what we can do as the families, but we're also using NGOs and so on and the politicians to make sure that there is a worldwide connection, not just in Europe, but all over the world, because we all have the same problem. We are all victims of this terrorist regime. So we all have to work together to find a solution.
Well, you were in Berlin late last month, meeting with various German officials to try to get some of this support that you're asking for. What kind of help did those German officials offer you when you met with them?
Well, looking back at the last 2.5 years where I have been trying to advocate for my dad from here, from Los Angeles, even though we're German citizens, so I was trying to reach them from here, we did not get much support. The German government did not give us much support. As we can see, my dad is now 970 days in solitary confinement. He has been tortured. He has no lawyer. He cannot contact us, and we don't know if he's alive or where he is, and he's about to be executed. So the support from these governments have been zero. That is why I took this risk, and it was a big risk. I was warned not to leave the U.S., just like my dad was warned not to leave the U.S.
Yes, you mentioned when you spoke to Kahan Life that while you visited Germany, you had some security guards protecting you. And I was curious, how did you learn about these threats to your own personal safety? And how long have you been facing these threats?
We are facing these threats as my family was facing them 16 years ago when they tried to kill my dad. So when they have you on the radar, like they did with my father, it's not just you who is under threat, it is your whole family. So I'm very, very used to it. Since I have become the face of my dad's campaign, things have changed a lot. So I'm aware of that. People around me are aware of that. The governments are aware of that because the government did not want me to travel. They said, this is a threat and you better stay where you are. So this means that we're again left on our own, where we have to find security companies to give us security, and just for traveling to my own home country, which is Germany.
I'm glad that you made it back from Germany safely. When you speak about your interactions with the U.S. government, we talked about Roger Carstens, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs. Have you had any contact and support from him?
That has been the big, big task in the U.S. right now. So these two governments, Germany is trying to get out of our way and push over the responsibility to the U.S. because I'm not there. I'm not physically there, so they can not deal with me. I am physically in the U.S., but the U.S. now has this excuse that my dad happens to not be a U.S. citizen, even though under the Levinson law that I just mentioned, after the Levinson family went through this ordeal, there is a law that says all U.S. nationals must be protected when they're taken hostage. And it does not define U.S. nationals as just somebody who has citizenship. It is permanent residents. It is the residents of these countries. So we are right now working with lawyers to make sure that the U.S. government adheres to the law that they have, their own laws, which means U.S. nationals must be protected, which my dad is, but he still has not received the protection that he should.
Well, you emphasized to Kahan Life the need for the West to implement a new strategy for dealing with Iran as basically a hostage-taking terrorist regime rather than as a normal government. So what kind of strategy do you think would be the most effective to get your father and other prisoners released?
I have to be very honest with you, Michael. I'm not a politician. I am not an expert in terrorist organizations. I have spoken to experts and they have been with me in Germany and brought different theories to the table. I am a critical care, coronary care nurse. I can tell you during the pandemic what we have to do, how to rescue people. Saving lives is my job.
That's your expertise.
That's my expertise. Nobody has to explain to me how to take care of my COVID patients, how to do anything. Nobody has to stand in front of our hospitals with hashtags and demonstrations and tell me to do my job. But unfortunately, we still have to do that with our governments. We still have to shake them and wake them and tell them, okay, even me as a layperson can tell you, when you're dealing with kidnappers in a regular case, you do whatever the kidnappers want to get your people out of there. Well, sometimes like give them a helicopter and $1 million if that's necessary to get the people out of there. But after you've saved your people, you will not sit down with them at a table, make deals with them, invite them to your country, invite them to the UN human rights or whatever, and have them talk about human rights. You will not do that. You will make sure that they're held responsible. You will make sure they can never, ever kidnap other people. But in the case of the Islamic regime, they started 44 years ago by kidnapping and hostage taking of the U.S. embassy over there. And they are still continuing up to this day the same thing that they were doing, because all of the Western countries get their citizens out or not, and then they continue dealing with these terrorists like they are some normal government. Get their people out again, continue dealing with them like a normal government, making money with them and so on. So even as a lay person, I can tell that this has been the wrong way of dealing with criminals. They all have to treat it the same way, not like governments, not like allies, not like business partners, but as terrorists.
Ghazal Sharmad, activist and daughter of Jamshid Sharmad, speaking to us from LA. Thank you for sharing your perspective with our audience, and my best wishes for your efforts to bring your father home.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me a voice.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.